This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Affirm Films and the Kendrick Brothers movie Overcomer, starring Alex Kendrick and Priscilla Shire, rated PG, parental guidance suggested, in theaters August 23rd. More information is available at overcomermovie.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thanks so much for joining us again. If there is anybody in public life today who takes more flack for being a Christian than Vice President Mike Pence, I don't know who it is. Vice President Pence is the constant target of progressives and atheists and even presidential hopefuls like Mayor Pete Buttigieg, all for the vice president's Christian views on all kinds of social and political issues. But how many Americans understand what he really believes and how he got here? We're going to talk about that today with Leslie Montgomery. She has been a writer for Focus on the Family for more than 20 years. She's the former director of publications for the American Association of Christian Counselors, as well as the founder of Yeshua Ministries. And today we'll be talking about her book, The Faith of Mike Pence. Leslie, great to have you with us. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Thank you for being
here. Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. I have been a fan of Mike Pence for a long time now. I know a lot of listeners would concur. Why take a look at the faith of Mike Pence? For a lot of people, they'll say, we know he's a Christian. What is so important for people to understand about how he became a Christian and where he is today?
Well, I'll tell you, the faith of Mike Pence, it's really a comeback story, not just personally and politically, but spiritually. You know, he was raised in a home that was full of faith. He was a Roman Catholic growing up. But when he got into his high school years, he said that he really believed that faith was really for other people. He went to Hanover College his freshman year. He began to hear other young adults talk about having a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, which just really wasn't his experience. He said he had fraternity brothers who had also been raised Roman Catholic that had become born again, and they began to witness to him, and over the course of several months, he became a born-again Christian. And his fraternity brother said it wasn't a step that he made when he became a Christian. It was really a leap, and he just dove in to the Word of God and prayer, and it was really a transformation in his life. He was already had the gift of servitude and wanting to serve the public in some way, but it really became a passion of his at that point.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that he was raised Roman Catholic in this strong Catholic family, and as you just said, he became a Christian when he realized there was more to Christianity than he had understood. You talk in the book about the fact that he thought wearing a cross around his neck would make him a Christian, which I thought was kind of funny. I said he's probably not the only person who's ever thought that way. But what was it about his conversion that really made the difference? How was it that he understood what it meant to be born again and come to personal faith in Jesus Christ?
Well, like a lot of people, one of the things he loved about the Catholic Church was the traditions, the ritualistic aspect of the church, but he didn't understand that it was about, in the Catholic Church, you're not encouraged to read the Bible a lot, and he didn't understand that it was about having a personal relationship with Jesus, and when he joined the fraternity as a freshman, his brothers started talking about, Jesus and having a personal relationship with Christ, and started talking about the stories in the Bible, and they started sharing the stories in the Bible, and he was really intrigued with that. And he started reading the Bible a little bit, and he started attending Vespers, which is, like a gathering where, young adults go at Hanover, and he was really enjoyed that gathering and the company. That it was a worship, a time of studying the Bible, and it was really intrigued by that. He ended up going to a Christian Woodstock, which is like Ithacus, where they had some preaching and some music, and he was really drawn to the fact that Jesus had died for his sins. That he was carrying a lot of guilt and shame from his, religious experience, and he learned that having a personal relationship was more than just religion, more than just rules, and was really engaged with the whole aspect of Jesus being a person more than him just being about stories.
Interesting. Well, didn't he also consider becoming a priest at one point?
He did, and that comes from not just the Catholicism aspect of serving people, but that comes from his gift. Like I said, he had a real gift of wanting to serve, and you see that in his public life, but he just really desired to serve and be in the middle of service. So he always thought about being a priest, even when he thought that religion was for other people. And all the way through, even after he had graduated from Hanover, he was debating with, should I be a priest or should I be a lawyer? And he went to his dad, and his dad said, well, I think you should, you know, be a lawyer. You can always become a priest later. He met with, one of the priests at his local church, and he's, you know, and talked about, well, what should I do? And he really wrestled with that. He was accepted to the Catholic University, but he ended up going to law school instead.
Yeah. Now, for a lot of evangelicals, they've been a little confused, I think, at times when they say, well, he grew up Catholic, but then he became a born-again Christian. But did he still go to Catholic church? Because later on, he and Karen, his wife, ended up going to an evangelical church, I think several evangelical churches over time. But where do you see him falling now on the spectrum of Catholicism and evangelicalism? Is he fully evangelical?
He is fully evangelical. You know, he has said that he likes the traditions, that, like I said, the traditions and that he grew up with in the church, you know, the Roman Catholic Church, but he is evangelical. He is Protestant. He ended up leading his wife, Karen, into a personal relationship with Jesus, and so they do worship in an evangelical church, and that's been, you know, they've been married over 35 years, and that's been what they've worshiped in.
Yeah. Are they in one particular church now that he's in Washington? I know a lot of times you will have presidents and vice presidents who don't want to cause an uproar by going to church. I know Ronald Reagan talked about that. But what is their current situation, the Pences, as far as a connection with a local church?
Well, they continue to go to church, but they, as you know, they travel a lot, so they go wherever they travel.
Makes sense. Yeah, makes sense. That's interesting. Did he have any particular big mentors along the way when it came to his Christian faith and discipling him along the way?
You know, he had some heavy hitter disciples, people who discipled him, like Ken Blackwell, who is also in politics.
Sure.
But mostly it was people initially like his fraternity brothers. He's had people like James Dobson, you know, people who have taken him under the wings in over the years. But his closest relationships, like his accountability brothers that were closest to him during the early years, you know, he's always had a group of people in his life that he was doing Bible studies with, that he had for accountability. He's always made sure that he's had close brothers in his life walking with him that would ask him the hard questions and hold him accountable in his life.
Right. Well, he still goes to that Bible study in Washington, right, from Ralph Jollinger?
Yes, he does. And matter of fact, there's a couple of guys, I just got off the phone with one of them a few minutes ago, that he still meets with every 3 or 4 days, and that they meet with accountability.
Wow.
Study the Bible with.
That's great. I mean, and that's got to be a difficult thing in his position. He's got an awfully big load to carry just in his public life to be able to break away and make that possible. That's really, I think, impressive.
Well, I mean, there's something to be said about anybody who welcomes accountability in their life.
Yes.
I mean, how many Christians really do that?
Oh, yeah. No, that's true. Much, much less politicians, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's not a normal thing. And it's interesting because you have this situation, obviously, with the vice president, where he is an extremely high-profile politician, but he also has that connection as well with the president of the United States, who has taken all kinds of flack, obviously, for his colorful background, as it were, and some of his, lack of connection to the Christian faith. How does
Sure.
that play out between the two of them?
Well, you know, I can't even begin to think where the president is spiritually, and so I don't even try to guess. There are some opinions that people who know them both personally have given throughout the book. But because I haven't spoken to the president or those around him, I don't feel like I'm able to, to comment on that. But what I can say is that I know that the vice president is definitely a voice in his ear.
Tell you what, Leslie, hang on just a second. We'll come back with Leslie Montgomery. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. More than likely, you've seen or heard about the recent abortion law in New York that allows babies to be aborted up to full term. Your heart breaks, but you're not sure how you can make a difference in a positive way. The Ministry of Preborn invites you to help be the change. Preborn is the largest provider of free ultrasounds in the country. And right now, the Preborn Center in the heart of New York City needs your help to stay open and help women choose life. When a woman sees her baby on an ultrasound, 8 out of 10 times, she'll choose life.
And I got to hear and see my baby for the first time. Hearing the heartbeat made me cry, and it was certain that I was going to keep my baby forever.
Would you join with Preborn in helping the New York City moms in crisis choose life? For $140, you can sponsor 5 ultrasounds and help save 5 babies' lives. To donate, dial 855-402-BABY. That's 855-402-BABY. Or there's a Preborn banner ad to click at janetmefford.com. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. We're discussing The Faith of Mike Pence, the new book from Leslie Montgomery. She's been a writer for over 20 years for Focus on the Family, and she is founder of Yeshua Ministries. And we're talking about the faith journey, as it were, of the Vice President of the United States. And I'd mentioned, Leslie, before the break that a lot of people have said, and you know, people on the left love to talk about this. How can a guy who's a strong Christian join hands with Donald Trump? How in the world does that work? But you had mentioned before the break that Pence has really been a voice in the ear of Donald Trump. And I'm curious about that, how much you discovered in that regard about the influence that he does have on the president and when it comes to Christianity.
Well, let me just say real quick that several people that I interviewed talked about how there's a number of examples in the Bible about godly, you know, men who influenced ungodly kings in the Bible. And we know that to be true about Daniel and other people. But, you know, the before Pence ever came along into Donald Trump's life, you know, Donald Trump was pro-choice. He was not an advocate of Israel. He was not involved with God's word, as far as we know. Since that time, he's been an advocate of Israel. He's been pro-life. He's now has Bible studies weekly in the West Wing. And so there has been some definite changes in the White House since Mike Pence has been chosen and has served as vice president, as we can see. So there's definitely an influence that we can see going on in the White House. My understanding is that the president now is asking a lot of questions about faith, questions that we would want somebody who is, you know, intrigued with the Bible, intrigued with God, that we want them to ask, right?
Right.
And I am told that someone actually said to me during the interview process is that President Trump is on the road to Damascus. Now, what exactly does that mean? I don't know.
Yeah.
So he's on his own journey. But I think definitely Mike is a part of that journey and whispering in his ear, and we can see reflections of that.
How does he react to those critics who say a man like you should have nothing to do with somebody like Donald Trump? I mean, how does he take on that barrage of criticism that he is somehow compromising his Christian faith by being on the same ticket and then winning the vice presidency with Donald Trump and somehow compromising?
Well, I think we have to remember that if we take that, you know, view with Mike Pence, we have to take it across the board with everybody. I mean, don't we all work for ungodly people?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, come on. You know, if we accuse him of that, then we all have to stop working for ungodly people. You know, we want to judge one person, but if we all did that, nobody would work for anybody.
Yeah, good point. What about the particular issue of homosexuality and Obergefell and all that stuff? His wife, Karen, as everybody knows, not too long ago, came under fire because she taught at a Christian school. And, they don't allow homosexual teachers. And, you know, Christians are saying, well, do you understand anything about Christianity? You know, and yet he took an awful lot of criticism, as did the second lady. He took a lot of criticism, I know, with the riffraff back in Indiana when he was governor there. Talk a little bit about that issue, because that is the issue that continues to come up with the vice president over and over and over.
Well, it is. If you look at his record before RFRA and after RFRA, there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that he's ever been discriminatory towards the LGBT community. None.
Right.
In fact, after RFRA, he is the only governor in Indiana history that has ever placed protections into law that has protected the LGBT community. That's it. And he's advocated for the LGBT community in several aspects. But the RFRA was never meant to be an LGBT issue, never. But what happened was I interviewed Lieutenant Governor Sue Ellspermann, who was right there in the trenches with him during that time, and she told me, she said it was about religious freedom.
Right.
It was never about the LGBT community, but someone made it about the LGBT community, and because of that, the more we said it wasn't about the LGBT community, the more they made it about the LGBT community. And so what happened was he ended up signing a new law into effect, but it's been, you know, repeatedly hit over the head with it, you know, since that time. But there's, you know, what can you do about that? You know, one of the things I'd like to bring up in regards to that is one of the lies that is continually perpetrated against Mike Pence is that, you know, that he's an advocate for conversion therapy.
Yeah.
Those words have never come out of his
no.
mouth.
No, no. And
never.
there's no such thing as conversion therapy either. You're going to get me off on a tangent here because I yell about that all the time. It's true. You're right. You're absolutely right about that.
I did the research on it. I looked for those words. They don't exist.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you look for them, what happens is, you know, people take things out of context. They take a little snippet and twist it. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why, you know, politicians and you know, musicians and artists get so angry towards the media is because they take things that people say and twist them and manipulate them, you know. But those words have never come out of his mouth.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they want to be angry. They want to take things personal. It's just like the Billy Graham role, you know. It's not personal. It's not about women being, you know, sexual temptress. It's not about him not being able to control himself around somebody else. It is about him honoring God. It's about him honoring his wife. It's about him, you know, abstaining from the appearances of evil. You know, it's about him, you know, being a godly man.
Yeah. Well, and it's so ironic because the same people who are screaming and yelling about the Billy Graham rule as if that's a bad thing are the same people screaming about the Me Too movement. I mean, why in the world would you not get behind a man who wants to be, you know, honorable and moral and be faithful to his wife? If you decry people who are dishonoring women, why would you also decry somebody who is honoring women, in particular one woman, his wife, unless you had a bigger issue, which was Christianity? I mean, and that's what I just keep coming back to, because he always seems to be the point person for anything that in particular LGBT activists are mad about. Hence some of the lies that they hurl at him because they're just mad. And you know, Leslie, this brings up an interesting issue, because when you're talking about the passage of RFRA in Indiana, Vice President Pence, then Governor Pence, signed that amendment, and you talk about this in the book, that made a lot of evangelicals say, well, wait a minute, I thought the purpose of this was to protect religious freedom, in particular for Christians, because they're the ones always in the crosshairs of these gay activists, but you ended up throwing a bone to these activists because they put so much pressure on you. Did you betray us? Talk about that a little bit, and what you think about, you know, what really happened there, and whether or not that was a betrayal of Christians who felt like he switched sides under pressure.
Yeah, and a lot of believers did feel like he had betrayed them, but it wasn't even about betraying Christians. He wanted to be able to, you know, protect religious freedom, but he also had to make it clear that it wasn't about discrimination against the LGBT community. And so he had to put language into it that protected both sides. And he had to do something to make sure that either side was not offended, you know. But, you know, he was in the middle where he couldn't please either side.
Yeah, it's not easy.
No, it's not easy.
Yeah. And it's got to be frustrating. Do you think in researching the book and doing the interviews and taking a broader look at the vice president's life as a Christian, that he really is the main person who gets the ire of the left because they are so mad that so many evangelicals put Trump in the White House? Do you think he kind of is the fall guy for a lot of us?
Absolutely. And you know what? I think that the left does not know what to do with a godly man like Mike Pence. I mean, think about it. They criticize the president for being, you know, allegedly being a whoremonger, and then they criticize Vice President Pence for not being one.
Right.
You know? How can you win? You know,
you can't.
What exactly do you want? You know, I mean, the vice president and the second lady have been married over 35 years, which is more than two-thirds of America. You know, I think we could learn something from their example, but still, he's criticized. You know, and one of the great things that I love about Mike Pence is that from the beginning of his congressional career on, you know, he went into it asking, you know, his accountability partners, asking those who know him, his friends, pray for me that my yes will be yes and my no will be no. You know, we always see politicians telling people, well, I promise I'll do this, I'll promise I'll do that, and then they flip-flop later on, right?
Yes.
They meet with lobbyists, and they change their mind, or they get into the House, and somebody scratches their back, so they flip-flop on an issue, and they scratch their back, and we go, what's going on? They promised this, and they did that. Mike Pence has never done that, not one time.
Yeah.
He's always followed through with what he said. He's remained, you know, pro-life. He's remained, you know, true on this issue. He's remained true on that issue. And so he has been steady Eddie for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
We can count on somebody like that. Don't you appreciate that about him?
He has outstanding character. I mean, it really
Absolutely.
Is a very rare thing. I'm curious, Leslie, did you get into much about when he went to the Southern Baptist Convention and you had people last year standing up on the House floor? I was there, so this is an issue. But there were people standing up saying, we shouldn't have invited Mike Pence. This is divisive. I mean, for people to be doing that on the floor of the Southern Baptist Convention is just insane. But did he have any particular comment on that? Or any sort of reaction to that of any type?
You know, he's so good about handling conflict. You know, he just takes it in stride. It's just like Taylor University this year.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a Taylor alumni, so I was just like, really? Come on.
Yeah.
We're supposed to be godly people.
Right.
Are you kidding me?
Right.
You know? I actually ended up writing a letter to the president saying, are you really, you know, I sent him a copy of the book and said, don't listen to this. You
Good.
Know, he's a godly man. You've got to read this book, you know,
Good.
But he, you know, he takes it all in stride. He knows who he is in Christ. You know, it's like, you know, one of the questions I often get asked is, how does he balance his faith and his role as a politician? Well, he doesn't have to balance it. He doesn't have to juggle it because his faith is who he is at the core of who he is.
There it is. Well, Leslie Montgomery, the book is called The Faith of Mike Pence. Leslie, great to have you with us. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Janet. Have a blessed day.
You too. All right. We'll be back. Stay with us. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Affirm Films and the Kendrick Brothers movie Overcomer, starring Alex Kendrick and Priscilla Shire, rated PG, parental guidance suggested, in theaters August 23rd. More information is available at overcomermovie.com. On Janet Mefford Today, I guess this just isn't surprising at all that we would find Chuck Schumer saying, hey, it's not enough that you Republicans would be potentially in favor of red flag laws after these mass shootings over the weekend. He put out a statement saying, we Democrats are not going to settle for half measures so Republicans can feel better and try to push the issue of gun violence off to the side. They want the House to be involved. Yeah. They said that any gun-related legislation moving through the Senate must be accompanied by a House bill requiring background checks on all gun purchasers. Well, we know what that's all about, and it's another step toward gun control. It's what they're about. It's why there's been such a fight over this every time we have a mass shooting. This is the direction they go. But I'll tell you what's really nerve-wracking about what's happening is you have increasingly, as you know, a radical group of Democratic hopefuls for the presidency who are just not afraid to be radicals anymore. You probably heard about the comments of frontrunner and former Vice President Joe Biden. He was doing an interview earlier this week with Anderson Cooper. You got to listen to what he had to say. Listen to cut one.
To gun owners out there who say, well, a Biden administration means they're going to come for my guns.
Bingo. You're right if you have an assault weapon. The fact of the matter is they should be illegal, period. Look, the Second Amendment doesn't say you can't restrict the kinds of weapons people can own. You can't buy a bazooka. You can't have a flamethrower. The guys who make these arguments are the people who say the tree of liberty is watered with the blood of patriots. We need the protection against the government. We need an F-15 for that. You need something well beyond whether or not you're going to have an assault weapon.
So how would you deal with all the assault weapons that are already out there that people have?
What I would do is I would institute a national buyback program, and I would move in the direction of making sure that in fact was what we tried to do, get them off the street.
But that's not confiscating people.
No, that's not walking into their homes, knocking on their doors, going through their gun cabinets, etc.
So people would be allowed to keep the weapons they already have.
Right now, there's no legal way that I'm aware of that you could deny them the right if they had legally purchased them. But we can, in fact, make a major effort to get them off the street and out of the possession of people.
Now, this is very significant, and John Nolte over at Breitbart also picked up on this, so I appreciate that other people are getting it. Did you notice how he said there at the end, right now, there's no legal way that I'm aware that you could deny them the right to have legally purchased firearms? Right now, there's no legal way. Right. There is no legal way right now. There's no mandatory buyback law right now. No laws have actually been passed that order Americans to give up their firearms. But you know what he didn't say? He didn't say, I would never confiscate guns. He said, bingo, and then cited assault weapons. But do you really think that this crowd is going to stop with assault weapons? Besides, didn't we already go through that with the assault weapons ban and it basically did nothing? And even people on the left agreed that it didn't work. Also, Biden didn't say he would never force people to give up the firearms they already own. He didn't really answer the question. He didn't want to answer the question. He didn't want to come out and say what he seems to actually think. Because, you know, you don't have to nuance and dodge and have all these little rhetorical sleights of hand when you can just come out and give your opinion. You know, straight shooters are really a breath of fresh air. Good or bad, it's nice to know where the person actually stands, but that's not the way of politicians, especially leftists. And by the way, he's not the only person who's been talking this way. Beto O'Rourke, as you might have heard, not that Beto's going anywhere, but Beto O'Rourke was on a podcast just recently and says that he is open to a mandatory gun buyback program in the United States. Now, this goes back to something we've talked about before, and that is the left loves to cite Australia and their mandatory gun buyback. That's gun confiscation, folks. They confiscated 700,000 to 1 million firearms in Australia, and the statistics coming back on if it really was necessary are really tenuous. It's not even, you know, this is the thing. It's not about keeping Americans safe per se. It never is with these people. What they propose is never what they're really proposing. Do you really believe that the proposal of Obamacare was about making medical care cheaper? Honestly, you think those people didn't know exactly what the astronomical price tag would be even as they were wanting to kind of keep single payer in the background and roll that out once Obamacare didn't work. I mean, we talked about this. I talked about this on the air in 2009. And this is the case. It happened exactly as we all predicted. A lot of people were onto this scheme. What will happen is it'll be an astronomical failure, you know, catastrophic failure. You're going to have premiums going through the roof. People are not going to get as good a care as they got when they had private health insurance and weren't on these exchanges. That's what happened. The individual mandate will force people to do things against their consciences. That happened despite the promise by Obama that, oh no, I will never make Americans pay for abortion if they don't want to. Bart Stupak, sign on. And Bart Stupak, okay, Mr. President, we'll sign on. Yeah, that worked out well. Pretty soon Bart Stupak was, you know, hastily handing in his resignation letter and scooting back up to Michigan with his tail between his legs. But that's another subject. I want to go back to June, because this is also important. Amy Klobuchar, the Minnesota senator, was asked during the first 2020 Democratic primary debate, if there is a mandatory buyback, would that involve gun confiscation? Listen to how this went. This is cut two.
Senator Klobuchar, the Iron Range, I'm curious, gun confiscation, right? If the government is buying back, How do you not have that conversation?
Well, that's not confiscation. You would give them the offer to buy back their gun. But I'll say this. I look at these proposals and I say, does this hurt my Uncle Dick and his deer stand, coming from a proud hunting and fishing state? These proposals don't do that. When I was a prosecutor, I supported the assault weapon ban. When I was in the Senate, I saw those moms from Sandy Hook come and try to advocate for change, and we all failed. And then now these Parkland kids from Florida, they started literally a national shift. You know why? It's just like with gay marriage. When kids talk to their parents and their grandparents, they say, I don't understand why we can't put these sensible things in place. Say, listen, and if we get bested by a bunch of 17-year-olds, it's the best thing
that
ever happened.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, it's just like gay marriage. What are you talking about? What are you talking about? Are you really trying to insinuate that the 17-year-olds of the country gave us gay marriage because they said, Mom, I don't understand why a man and a man can't get married? And then with tears in our eyes as good leftists, we said, please, Supreme Court, please redefine marriage. That never happened. That never happened. That's a whole nother subject. But she's insane. What is she talking about? We have to listen to David Hogg. That guy is off the rails. He's a filthy mouthed, angry young man who needs, you know, better parental mentoring and adult mentoring, I should say. I don't know what kind of parents he has, but he needs better adult mentoring. That's all I will say on that subject. One more thing I want to play, though, because this came to mind as well. Do you remember back in February, at the time when President Trump was saying, I'm going to declare a national emergency to deal with the situation on the border and get the funding I needed? Do you remember what Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, said then? Listen to this quote in context with what we have been through this past week. Listen to cut three.
The president is doing an end run about Congress, about the power of the purse. You've heard me say over and over again, Article 1, the legislative branch, the power of the purse, the power to declare war, many other powers listed in the Constitution, and, of course, the responsibility to have oversight. So the president is doing an end run around that. We will review our options. We'll be prepared to respond appropriately to it. I know the Republicans have some unease about it, no matter what they say, because if the president can declare an emergency on something that he has created as an emergency, an illusion that he wants to convey, just think of what a president with different values can present to the American people. You want to talk about a national emergency? Let's talk about today, the one-year anniversary of another manifestation of the epidemic of gun violence in America. That's a national emergency. Why don't you declare that emergency, Mr. President? I wish you would. But a Democratic president can do that. Democratic president can declare emergencies as well.
Just keep that in your back pocket, because that's something else they could have up their sleeve if they are able to get a progressive into the White House. Well, President Trump declared a national emergency at the border. The Supreme Court at the end of July ruled 5-4 that the president may use military funding for constructing the border wall. So who knows? And I'm not blaming it on Trump. These people would do it anyway. They didn't need Trump to declare or not declare a national emergency at the border in order to come up with that scheme. Hey, let's just declare a national emergency on gun violence and take away people's Second Amendment rights. Because, you know, adding an amendment to the Constitution would be too cumbersome. We must move. We must move quickly. These people are really scary. We're going to come back. You're listening to Janet Mefford Today. Don't go away.
From Affirm Films, Provident Films, and the Kendrick Brothers comes Overcomer. John Harrison is a frustrated coach questioning his value until he crosses paths with a student struggling on her own journey.
What have you allowed to define you? When you find your identity and the one who created you, it'll change your whole perspective. You
Overcomer, starring Alex Kendrick and Priscilla Shirer. Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested. In theaters August 23rd. More information is available at overcomermovie.com.
If you're looking for adventure, serving as a volunteer on the Mercy Ship is an adventure like no other. And you'll be serving on the largest non-governmental hospital ship in the world, providing free care to some of the world's poorest people. Whether it's performing a surgery, cleaning the deck, or transporting a patient to a recovery center, every day you'll be making a difference in the lives of struggling people. Begin your adventure today. Connect with us at mercyships.org. It's an adventure of a lifetime.
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 a month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. In addressing the recent mass shootings in El Paso and in Dayton, one of the problems President Trump cited was that of the glorification of violence in our society, and he mentioned violent video games as just one example. Many media outlets try to downplay that there's any problem in that regard, but there's new research out suggesting that exposure to violence in the media can increase children's dangerous behavior around real firearms. We're going to talk about it now with Tim Winter, president of the Parents Television Council, which has been making this point about media violence for a long time. Tim, great to have you with us again. How are you?
I'm well, Janet. Good day to your listeners. It's a pleasure to be on the horn with you once again.
Well, wonderful. Glad to have you here. What is your reaction to President Trump's point about the glorification of violence in our society? Because I saw an awful lot of pundits saying, oh, how in the world could you link violent video games to what happened in El Paso and Dayton, as if it's not even a salient point?
Well, when you look at the scientific research, and we're not talking just about violent video games, we're talking about an entertainment media culture that is saturated with violence and gun violence. When you look back at almost 70 years of research, there is unwavering conclusion that a violent media culture is one of the contributing factors to violence in our society, and in particular, the mass shootings. As a matter of fact, we've seen research published from Iowa State University that suggests it's among the top three contributing factors to the mass shootings that we're seeing right now. So the folks who say there is no impact are wrong. It is an impact. It may not be the number one impact, but it is among the top three, and that's why we're making such a fierce call to Hollywood to tone it down, especially to the content that's being marketed to children.
Well, right. Now, this research that you've talked about in Psychology Today that discusses exposure to violence in the media being a connecting factor to children acting more dangerous when they get around real guns. What kinds of ramifications have there been when there is that media violence and children who may be unstable, or teenagers, young men in this case, who may be unstable? How does that play out in real life?
Well, basically what you have is a desensitization that happens in the brain. And keep in mind, I'm not a scientific researcher. I'm an advocate. But I have read, I can't even imagine how many pages of the scientific research over the years. But what we've seen is science that shows the chemical reaction in the brain, in the human brain, when someone is in the middle of consuming, or especially with the violent video games, they're actually perpetrating the acts of violence, not just watching, but they're actually taking the triggers and pulling the triggers.
Right.
But when they are doing that behavior, they are triggering a chemical reaction in the brain that is similar to the chemical reaction that happens when we face real-life violence. It draws the two closer together. There is there's been MRI imaging done on young male brains who are engaged in this activity, and it shows the same chemical reaction, the same stimulus that happens in with real violence. What they become are dress rehearsals for tragedy.
That's awful. Well, I know one of the things that you guys have worked on is trying to get the CW to tone down the violence on their show, in particular the show called Arrow. Can you tell us a little bit about that and the connection? We're talking about video games, but it, you know, also when you have children tuning into TV shows that are violent. What's been going on over at the CW?
Yeah, CW has, you know, it's a very small broadcast network. It's not as big as NBC, CBS, ABC, or Fox, but it is a national broadcast network. And it contains an awful lot of programming that is based upon comic book characters, everything from the Arrow and Supergirl, and even when I was a kid, it was Archie and Jughead.
Yes.
With the Archie comics. Now it's called Riverdale. And what we have seen is now these are comic book themed characters that it's live action. It's not animation. But it's based on a franchise that was built on the back of children and is inherently attractive to children. And we are seeing more and more graphic sex, violence, profanity. Even Archie, the little Archie character, which is now, of course, live action, is having sexual relations with his school teacher in the backseat of his car.
Oh, man.
I mean, that's how far things have come from the comic books that we used to read as kids to the comic book characters being depicted on broadcast. This isn't even cable or streaming. On broadcast television today.
It's just a sewer. Well, I read this quote from Mark Pedowitz, his name, I guess, is this president of the CW, responding to your call by saying that he and his staff are very cognizant of the violence levels in their shows and have asked creators to tone things down if they think plots have gone too far. So they're going to self-regulate. I guess that seems to be the answer, as if that would really happen.
It sounds to me like he's asking the inmates to run the asylum more responsibly.
Yeah,
I don't think that's really going to happen.
Right.
But it was you know, an arrogant and a disrespectful, you know, just a dismissal, I should say, of our concern. It is a punt that we are all too familiar with in Hollywood. No one will ever in Hollywood seem to step up and take accountability for anything. And what's interesting is in Hollywood, Hollywood celebrates the portrayals of situations that they believe are advancing their causes, their agenda across the nation. But they refuse to take any acceptance or of any accountability for the negativity that they are spewing, for the violence, for the culture of violence. They are happy to proclaim success. Look at what we were able to now mainstream. And yet they're mainstreaming violence, and they say, well, that actually has no effect. It's the height of hypocrisy. And we're not going to allow it to stand.
Yeah. You know what really strikes me, Tim, is, you know, several decades ago, you had an awful lot of people, even across the political spectrum, who were really trying to draw attention to harmful things and images in media that would have an effect, a deleterious effect on children's minds and the way that they played out in real life. Now it seems like There are a lot of people that just are taking it in stride. I'm wondering what your reaction is to that, how our culture has changed and how it seems that there are lots of Americans who would look at these shows and say, shrug, so what?
You know, there are a lot of cliches we can throw at the frog in the boiling water that doesn't notice when the temperature goes up and all of a sudden is boiled. You know, I think we as a nation have become fatigued by the debate, but I think that you're exactly right. You know, a number of years ago, people were more quickly outraged, and I think they've just been worn down.
Yeah.
That's why I redouble my efforts every day when I go into the office. You know, we're fighting here for the innocence of children, for their health, their welfare, their moral compass. That the entertainment media is I don't think intentionally all the time, but certainly by, you know, the result is that kids are being turned in a direction that is opposite of what the values of parents are trying to instill in their children. Yeah. And whether it's sexual conduct, whether it's profanity, whether it's disrespect for the law, drug use, violence, any host of other issues that are, you know, are concerning to your listeners, there is irrefutable proof that the entertainment media is having an impact on them. And at some point, we have to say, are we going to allow it to continue? Is this the new standard? Are we going to throw up our hands and say, you know, we can't do anything? Or are we going to redouble our efforts and say, thus far and no farther?
Yeah, that's why I love you guys so much, because you are continuing to fight the fight, which is a necessary and very right fight to fight. I go back to one of the continual things that comes up whenever we're discussing the effects of media on young minds. And, you know, I think you were the one who initially said this. Here you will have companies and corporations spending millions for a 30-second ad during the Super Bowl. So people obviously understand the power of media in somebody's life. They will spend millions to get you to go out and buy a bag of chips. But on the other hand, a lot of these same people will say, these TV shows don't really have that big of an effect. Nobody really cares. It's just entertainment. Have you found anything, Tim, research-wise, that speaks to the issue of children not being able to tell whether something is entertainment versus something that is real? Because I would imagine the younger you are, your brain's not fully formed. It would be harder, I would think, for a young child to look at that stuff and to be able to say, oh, it's not real. It's not entertainment. It's just entertainment. I shouldn't take it seriously.
There is very powerful research that shows exactly that, Janet. There is research that shows, and I can't remember the exact age. I think it's 6 or 7, but I don't remember the exact off the top of my head. But that a child who is consuming entertainment media is incapable, at that young brain development stage, is incapable of distinguishing fact from fiction, truth from reality, fantasy from real life. They're incapable. And when they see something, they think it's real. And that's why our concern is that at even younger and younger ages, this stuff is being marketed to kids. You know, I have stated what I believe is a Hollywood war on children. And people say, oh, you quit being so hyperbolic. You know, a few years ago, if it was marketed to adults and kids watched, then people would shrug, oh, parents should be better. But now the entertainment distribution platforms, the producers, the creators, and the networks are intentionally overtly targeting children with the messages. And so that's why I'm saying this is no longer just collateral damage for children. They are being intentionally targeted. They are in the crosshairs. This is a war on our children.
Tim Winter from the Parents Television Council. This hour of Janet Mefford Today brought to you by Affirm Films and the Kendrick Brothers movie Overcomer, starring Alex Kendrick and Priscilla Shire. Rated PG in theaters August 23rd. More information available at overcomermovie.com. We'll see you next time.